Thanks for listening to us on the Jefferson Exchange. We always appreciate your time and attention and invite you to join our conversations here. The phone number is 800-838-3760. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. When the wave of the Me Too movement crested a couple of years ago, many people felt a great sense of relief that we were finally talking frankly about the widespread occurrence of sexual misconduct, sexual harassment, and sexual assault. Now comes the time for going beyond reaction to action, to taking what we've learned and shaping a world in which the bad behavior of the past does not continue into the future. Our guest this hour studies the topic and has written a book. Sylvia Ann Hewlett is the author of Me Too in the Corporate World, subtitled Power, Privilege, and the Path Forward. Sylvia Ann Hewlett is a labor economist, consultant, and teacher. She's the founder of the Center for Talent Innovation, focused on developing senior executives who see, value, and employ the entire global talent pool. Sylvia is the author of 12 previous books. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange, Sylvia Ann Hewlett.
Well, Jeffrey, it's great to be on your show. Very well-known forum here.
Yeah, well, thank you. So was your own career trajectory altered by an encounter with a sexual assaulter?
It most definitely was. And the fascinating thing is that I did have a pretty distressing, I guess, both piece of harassment and assault in when I was 23, which, you know, forced me out of the management consulting world and changed the trajectory of you know, what I did with my life. And, you know, in some ways, I did what a lot of women did back then. You know, we buried it. I didn't even tell the sister I was living with, who I was very close to, because I think the sense of shame was so sharp. I turned the guy down, but, you know, I was riddled with this sense that maybe I did something to trigger it. Just last night, I read the kind of one-page story at an event at Barnes & Noble's, and, you know, I found myself choking up yet again because it seemed so fresh. Actually talking about this thing I had buried for so many years. The thing that made it so difficult was that I was a brand new employee at this very Tony London consulting firm. I'd just been out of college 18 months, and I kind of didn't come from the establishment. I came from a blue-collar family in South Wales, you know, a coal mining family. And this sophisticated world was brand new to me. I also, you know, think that one reason I was picked on was not only was I one of the very few new recruits who was female, but I was also from this, you know, powerless background. I had gone to the wrong school. That kind of thing. So I think I was seen as easy prey. But what happened to me was that the managing partner of the firm, someone called Sebastian Tyler, showed up in my cubicle, you know, one Friday afternoon and invited me to join him in his office for a stiff drink, as he put it. And he, you know, leant over the glass partition of my cubicle and really was, you know, kind of leering at me. I'd only met the guy once before. I'd met him at the Christmas party where he'd introduced me to his wife, for heaven's sake. So I kind of shrank back and said, you know, I'm very sorry, but I can't do that. I'm meeting friends after work and, you know, I'm going to leave here at 5 today. And so he kind of straightened himself up and thought for a moment, and he leant back over and he said, I tell you what, I'd be very happy with a hand job. You know, that doesn't take much time. You'll be out of here in a jiffy. And, you know, it was so degrading somehow, as though, you know, I should be available for hand jobs on Friday afternoon.
And
I was gobsmacked. I didn't know what to do. I actually fled the building at that point. And then I thought a lot over the weekend, and I had some very bad options. because he was the biggest rainmaker in the company. I knew that. And he was kind of untouchable. And I knew that if I turned him down, he would get super vindictive because, you know, he was a very entitled man. I used to get in his own way. And his retaliation, I knew, would mean that I would lose my job. And he had the power of blackballing me for my next job. So my immediate strategy was to lay low, try and avoid him, that kind of thing. And I did that successfully for about 10 days. But, you know, the next week, what happened is that he tracked me to the Xeroxing room, which was where, you know, the copying was done, that kind of thing. He found me there on my own. He turned the light off. He shut the door. And he just laid into me. He, you know, ripped my blouse off, you know, started twisting my nipples. It was just the most brutal encounter. And I yelled. And in fact, I yelled so loudly that he backed off for a minute and I got out. But as I left that Xeroxing room, I had to deal with a crowd of, you know, curious coworkers. Nearly all of whom were men.
Right, and we need to get to a break here in just a moment, but I want to point out that, and of course, the only refuge you really had after talking to several people who were important people to you was just get out. You know, this is the only thing you could do at the time, and so this is what we're talking about changing in the world today. Sylvia Ann Hewlett's book is called "Me Too in the Corporate World: Power, Privilege, and the Path Forward." We'll resume the conversation here on the Jefferson Exchange, and you can join in with your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio, I was just marveling at the fact that we don't even have to say things like sexual assault, sexual misconduct, sexual harassment in the workplace because we've actually shortened it to the characters hashtag MeToo. That is exactly what we're talking about today with Sylvia Ann Hewlett, who has spent many years in the corporate world, is focused on developing executives who see and value and employ the entire global talent pool. Her latest book is called MeToo in the Corporate World, Power, Privilege, and the Path Forward. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Sylvia, your own harrowing experience has certainly led to where you've gotten today. And as you run through the historical public cases in the book, you know, for example, Anita Hill and Monica Lewinsky, it seems like we've had, you know, blow-ups, but then, you know, that seems to recede. Do you think we've, with the Harvey Weinstein criminal trial, for example, going on as we speak, have we finally, you think, reached a tipping point, turned a corner, opened a door that won't shut?
I think we have. One thing I do in this book is really show that the costs of doing nothing are huge. I take a look at hits to the brand. For instance, you know, when Nike lost 11 of its leaders in the sexual scandals this last year, the analysis showed that there was a huge hit to the brand. Now, the Nike brand's worth about $15 billion, you know, not 10% of that, and you've got real money that you have just lost. So, the brand is one thing because, you know, you can see that very carefully, you know, created capital just disappear. The other big hit is obviously lawsuits. If you take, you know, Michigan State University, where the gymnasts were, you know, Larry Nassar was the evil man there. The costs of their lawsuits are now hitting $1 billion. So lawsuits is a number two thing. The third thing that is happening is that there is a fall in the share prices. You know, when CBS got hit with so many scandals, including Les Moonves, the shares, you know, plummeted by 9%. And the final thing, and this, of course, has been very important to me because it's somewhere where I have done a lot of work, is there's these this hollowing out of the talent pipeline. You know, increasingly, women over the last few years are losing mentorship, losing sponsorship because, you know, men are heading to the hills. they feel that it's kind of too risky to seriously advocate for a more junior female because of gossip, because all kinds of things might stick to them. And one of the big changes, I think, in how corporations are dealing with these issues, first off, they're, you know, taking it much more seriously because of the mounting costs. But they're also realizing that they need due process. You know, you can't just fire people on the spot because that is profoundly scary to all of your other executives. There needs to be an external investigation. There needs to be credible evidence, that kind of stuff. But if that is gone through in the right kind of way, it is perfectly, you know, a kind of zero tolerance policy that needs to go into place to, you know, get rid of sexual predators. But I think there's a lot happening right now in terms of due process. You know, we kind of don't want any more Al Franken's. And there is a lot happening in the seriousness with which the leadership culture is being shifted and changed.
I want to point out this book is not just anecdotes and your own impressions and observations. I mean, you've actually surveyed or had the Center for Talent Innovation survey thousands of people and did a lot of interviews as well.
Right. And, you know, one thing that has yielded, first off, a whole bunch of action steps, which are happening, and I'd love to talk about those. But secondly, what I discovered with this new data, which is kind of post-Me Too data, is that the problem is much more widespread than we think. For instance, you know, 34% of women experience sexual harassment at work. This is, you know, a representative sample of white-collar Americans. Good data, I did it with the University of Chicago. But this is the big surprise. 13% of men also experience sexual harassment at work. And the biggest group within the male victims are men of color. They seem to be very specially targeted. It's as though they're easy prey. And, you know, last night I spoke with Cornell West in the public forum to tangle with why that is and what to do about it. And in a fascinating way, this mirrors what has happened to the military. Because, again, you know, men are oftentimes the targets. This is a largely all-male environment, and male-on-male sexual misconduct has always happened in the military. But disproportionately, it's black men who are victimized. And, you know, there's at least some research around that, and I think it has lessons, if you like, for corporate America, which is kind of fascinating.
Well, you know, you mentioned men of color. We're talking to Sylvia Ann Hewlett about her book, Me Too in the Corporate World. You mentioned the Terry Crews case in the book, and this is a man who weighs 260 pounds and used to play football. And but he told the story of who harassed him, and it was a man who worked for the agency that managed him. Obviously, that's
Adam
all.
Adam Bennett,
I guess the part that gets me, and this, you know, cue the eye roll here, but, you know, Senator Dianne Feinstein asking him in a Senate hearing, why weren't you violent?
Yes. Well, can I tell a very short different story? This is a black executive in the publishing world.
Sure.
He, a dignified man, you know, a squeaky keen family life, being a publisher of several papers, some of them on the West Coast. He had been stalked by a younger white female executive at the company. And for 2 years, he put up with it. And she was quite, I guess, in his face. I mean, she started up to him all the time, telling him what a black guy he was, and she was increasingly hard to stay away from because he did stalk him. So I asked him, you know, why he did not report this, because he was number three in the company, and she was junior to him. And he said he really was afraid of the reaction. He said two things he thought would happen. First off, he'd become the office joke. I mean, why wasn't he happy that some younger, rather beautiful female was, you know, making advances? Shouldn't he be happy about that? You know, it's kind of the stuff of wet dreams. And, of course, he experienced it with great distress. But he said the other thing, which was even more scary, is that he was afraid that if he reported her, she would turn the tables and say, hey, guys, you know, he got it all wrong. He was attacking me. And she would be the one that would be believed. So he did not tell the CEO until it got so bad that he had to get a police restraining order against her. And at that point, he did tell his CEO, who shrugged it off and told him that surely it was a very minor matter.
So
nothing happened to her.
Have we gotten to a point then, Sylvia, where people are not being told to shrug it off anymore? I mean, do you think there's any of that left?
I think if it's a woman, we now have got that story. You know, we're ready to both hear and believe the victim. But this data is only, you know, a few months old. What I'm saying is that right now only 3% of black men who experience sexual violence at work, and we're talking white-collar workers, we're not talking about the prison system, you know, we're talking about college grads at work. Only 3% of black men report for those kinds of reasons. They fear the humiliation of being turned into a joke. And they fear that the tables will be turned.
Sylvia Ann Hewlett, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She's the writer of many books. She's a labor economist, consultant, teacher. She's the founder of the Center for Talent Innovation. Her latest book is called Me Too in the Corporate World, Power, Privilege, and the Path Forward. Some observations, some numbers from surveys done by the Center for Talent Innovation, plenty of interviews in the book, and some recommendations as well that we will get to with your help. Join us on the Exchange to talk about sexual harassment, misconduct in the workplace. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. In the interviews, did you find, Sylvia, many people who walked away or changed careers or just changed their lives because they didn't feel like they could work within the organization to correct the issue?
I did. And, you know, there's data to show that. In Silicon Valley right now, 60% of those who voluntarily leave, these are engineers, you know, STEM talent, those folks that everyone wants to employ, these are very regrettable leaves from the company's point of view. 60% say they are leaving because of predatory, toxic cultures. And if you look at those figures hard, a lot of them are women, but many of them are diverse individuals. You know, Middle Easterners, folks who are immigrants, people who feel that they are targeted, and obviously people who cannot speak up. Because if you're on a visa, which, you know, means you're a little vulnerable, you're not about to complain. That is a group that, again, does not report.
Let's talk about the responses in the corporate world. You already mentioned that there are concerns about hits to the brand, lawsuits, and share prices, which are all financial issues. I mean, are corporations basically amoral? They're only going to change their behavior when forced to because the circumstances of business change, or are they taking some greater sense of ownership of what they need to do to correct what led to Me Too?
I think both things are true. You know, if you've done the kind of half-day interviews that I've done with people recently, you do understand that leaders in the corporate world care about ethical behavior. They care about respect, and they care about inclusion. But obviously we're talking about profit-making organizations driven by revenue growth, et cetera. So I think you need both things to happen to cause change to actually, start moving. Let me just tell you one thing, which is very interesting. I did an interview with someone called Bradford Hugh, who is the chief risk officer at Citi. Now, Citi is a massive financial firm, as we all know. It has over 400,000 employees. It's like a small country. And he said, these issues of sexual misconduct are newly on his docket. You know, they're not often the D&I, diversity and inclusion, human resource area. They're in the chief risk officer's, sphere of responsibility these days. And he said that's because it's now a strategic risk. If we're dealing with something that could, shave 10% off the share value next week, we have to figure out how to mitigate that risk, how to make it incredibly unlikely. And you see, that's the kind of change in attitude that's happening. And clearly, we've seen companies, disappear because of these scandals, whether it's Wynn Resorts or the Weinstein Company. But we also have seen companies really disabled. If you think about, Lululemon or Guess Jeans, these companies sell the world on an image of female health, female wellness, female beauty. And if it turns out that, the leadership is riddled with predatory sexual behavior by the owner or the founder, it does terrible things to your brand. And Nike itself now says that they're struggling in the kind of female sports apparel marketplace, which is the fastest growing piece of their market, because of the way in which their brand has been tarnished, by the not just sexual misconduct, but pay inequity and bullying and, the bro culture mm-hmm. that Nike, we now understand, has had. So I do feel that these are kind of economic drivers of much faster change than we would have if we were just reliant on there being, proper, upright, respect-filled people at the top of corporations.
Is there any consensus that has formed about the bad actors? I mean, they're generally getting forced out of their companies now. The companies sometimes die, as you pointed out. It doesn't seem like they're giving big payouts anymore when some of these people are let go. But is there any consensus forming about whether the bad actors should ever work again in that business or anywhere? You do mention the likes of Louis C.K. in your book, who is back doing stand-up comedy.
Right. In the, the kind of standard corporate world, I'm not talking about entertainment so much, but if you think of a company like IBM, oftentimes thought of as a model company in terms of how it deals with employee issues, and certainly has always been on the forefront of, female leadership, and, they have a female CEO. So it's a much admired company. Well, IBM is quietly doing a very complex and very good thing on how you deal with offenders, people who are accused of sexual impropriety or, even sexual harassment and assault. They, A, are huge on investigations, so that there's not a summary kind of judgment, you know, which, you know, just pushes someone out overnight. But secondly, for mild offenses, they have kind of a road to redemption. It all depends on the attitude of the person as well as, you know, how serious was the offense. But if the middle-level manager or the leader, whoever is the accused person, is suitably genuinely sorry for having stepped over some line and will pay themselves for the training and kind of reorientation they need to get back on probation in a job at the firm, they are open to that.
Okay, it's interesting to know that there is something like that out there, IBM, and I assume there are a few other companies following them.
Yes, no, I use IBM because it's just such a big player, but I think that's increasingly where some of the more thoughtful, you know, companies are coming to, that, you know, if there is too much of a rush to judgment and everyone's all put in the same bag and, you know, mild offenses are somehow the same as, you know, brutal offenses.
Okay, we have to break it off there. We did a short break here, and we're talking about Me Too in the corporate world with Sylvia Ann Hewlett, back on the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Sylvia Ann Hewlett, well-known labor economist, consultant, teacher, feminist, founder of the Center for Talent Innovation, author of a dozen other books, including one with Cornell West. She's talking about sexual harassment in the workplace and sexual misconduct in the book Me Too in the Corporate World, Power, Privilege, and the Path Forward. You can join the conversation on the Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Sylvia, I want to come back to the sponsorship mentorship issue that you raised earlier.
Yeah.
It is a very important point of the book. Are you saying that companies that have kicked out harassers and assaulters also have executives afraid to help guide women up the ladder?
Exactly. That is true. And particularly if people were kicked out without any investigation. Because then everyone gets scared, you know, whether they are have skeletons in their closet or not. So one important chapter in this book, I think, is how the heck to make sponsoring or mentoring a younger talent who is different from you, because obviously we don't just need to worry about having junior women, you know, somehow feeling uncomfortable, but also men of color, LGBT individuals, because as I show in my data, these are groups that have all, you know, also had more than their fair share of this kind of problem. And what I do is actually create a framework for success. There's very easy steps you can take as a leader to ensure that everyone sees this as safe and respect-filled. You know, some of them are very commonsensical. As a leader, you certainly shouldn't invade personal space. You know, you shouldn't be doing executive coaching sessions with your protege at bars late at night. When you're traveling together, you should meet in the business center or the lobby, not in hotel rooms. I mean, all of this seems very obvious, but obviously, you know, although it sounds obvious, it has been happening. But I think the things that I recommend, which I really distill from a lot of my work on sponsorship, there are deeper ways you can make this really work, too. For instance, at Google and American Express, they encourage their leaders to be very noisy and boisterous and public about why the heck they're sponsoring this younger person. You know, share her resume. Make sure that your, you know, Middle Eastern immigrant protege leads a presentation to a client, and everyone starts to understand that the reason you singled this person out for, you know, special, say, training, is because they're kind of brilliant. They really have the goods. Don't make it behind closed doors. You know, be boisterous. I love that word. You know, Google uses that word as they advise their leaders. And I guess the other thing, Jeffrey, to make clear is why it's important, why it's valuable to continue to do this. One thing I always say, look, just remember, the biggest emerging market in the world is not China. It's women. This is the fastest growing piece of disposable income, you know, in the marketplace these days, and it's growing at a faster pace than anything else. So everyone wants, you know, to get a share of the female marketplace, and having gender smart around decision-making tables makes it much more likely that you can innovate for this marketplace in ways that give you a competitive advantage. So, you know, returning to the old days where it was a homogeneous leadership reality is not good for the bottom line. And well, right now, 60% of women in middle management positions say that they're having a harder time getting advocacy from the top because men are scared. So, again, it threatens the future. And it certainly threatens the lives of those women because, just think of it, if 60% of you stall out in a career because you just can't get the kind of, you know, megaphone around your talents that you need if you're going to make an impression for a top job, many of them will leave and end up, you know, many of them go into entrepreneurial activities. I kind of know where they go. And there's a great deal of disappointment on the women's part and lack of, I guess, the right kind of talent for the future on the part of companies.
Sylvia, let's back up to a really broad focus then, because I keep thinking about the concept of men being afraid to sponsor or mentor women. But I mean, aren't there a fair number of women executives now, or is it still a really small pool?
Well, 16% of executives are women.
Wow.
And that's now been true for 20 years. And 8% of the top earners in the economy are female.
8%. Okay, so the other 92% then are men.
Yes,
wow.
Right. So, you know, those men are pretty important. Middle management has a rich kind of participation by women. I always call that the marzipan layer. It's very rich. It's packed with all kinds of diverse talent, including women, and it's sticky. Hard to get out of it. So, you know, 35% of the middle ranks are now female. But it's not good enough just being a fantastic performer with terrific credentials and off-the-wall ambition. You have to have a sponsor because if you're going to get a top job, because someone has to be speaking up on your behalf behind closed doors in rooms where you're not present. And, of course, you know, the pyramid becomes steep, and there's always a 9 or 10, you know, great performers competing for top jobs. So you have to have this sponsorship thing, otherwise it doesn't happen.
So your action agenda features essentially three prongs: one, legal remedies; two, individual action steps, some of which you've covered already; and then three, company action steps.
Yes.
So let's start with the legal remedies. A few things you'd like to change: non-disclosure agreements and arbitration among them. Would you give us a short list?
You know, I do. I feel that the legal system's doing a pretty good job in shifting the big picture, and I'll give you two examples. New York State recently extended the statute of limitations so that if you were abused as a child, you're still able to complain and get and seek justice until you're 54, which is amazing. And when that change was made a couple of months ago, it wasn't just the Catholic Church that was hit with a whole new set of cases, very justifiably hit, I think. It was the Boy Scouts. It was the Mormon Church. It was Rockefeller University. All of these kind of august institutions are all of a sudden now feeling the heat. Because, you know, what we've learned, I think, from child sex abuse is that it does take several decades for individuals to become comfortable with telling the truth. So, I mean, that's a big shift in the legal system. I think 18 states are about to copy that. So the legal system is moving in the right direction. I think for an individual, you know, senior associate or vice president in the corporate world, there is still a bunch of very poor options. I do feel that, you know, not having binding arbitration clauses, not having NDAs all over the place, make a small difference. But going the route of litigation is out of the question for most people. It's just way too expensive, right? And there's still a kind of retaliation in the culture. So I don't feel that there's been much progress at the individual level, and I'm not sure there will be, because somehow, you know, our litigation, system doesn't lend itself readily to easy reforms. I mean, think of the Harvey Weinstein case. It looks as though there are only two women telling stories that actually count, right? Because everyone else is dealt out for one reason or another. And they're getting chewed up. So, I mean, I'm glad he's getting tried. It's not clear that these women will win. And even if they do win, it's not clear he would pay anything, because it's all being paid by his former company's insurance. So I don't place a lot of stock in legal solutions.
Right, so this moves on to the
these, you know, broad societal changes, like the New York State ruling on statute of limitations.
Right, and as you point out, the states do seem to be moving faster than the feds on the laws.
Yes.
Let's move on to the individual action steps. Some of this you mentioned already about, you know, the ways that we respect each other's space. I mean, some of this is fairly obvious, but there's an interesting one in here where you say, don't be tardy, defensive, or self-absorbed.
Yes. You know, there's a rabbi in Washington that's given some amazing free advice in a podcast and a sermon she gave on how leaders should respond when they're credibly accused of sexual misconduct. And, you know, I reproduce this in the book. It's actually worth reading because it's so beautifully written by her. but at the essence is to not just see this as some vicious attack on you that you have to be defensive about, but immediately get in the shoes of the person who you have hurt. And do it quickly. Being tardy, being defensive, just heightens the pain, makes it much worse for you in the long run. And the other thing to do is to, you know, make some kind of reparation happen. Reparation can be community service, can be a lot of things, right? It doesn't have to be money. But there are a few examples in the book of people who've done it well. I mean, think of Les Moonves, or think of many of the men that have been, you know, fingered or being credibly accused. The bitterness, the self-righteousness, the sense of having their birthright being, you know, stripped from them as though they're the ones that have been aggrieved.
Right, a real sense of how dare you.
Yes, exactly. I mean, that is a terrible way to go. And, you know, pretty much against every religion there is. So I love the fact I could find this rabbi who, you know, set it out so beautifully. Les Moonves, you know, the last year he was in his job, he had his secretary take the sexual harassment training program for him.
So she took it and he did not.
Yeah, and then she was supposed to report back to him about what was in it. But it was beneath his dignity.
Hmm. So this moves on to company action steps, which is the third prong of your action agenda. And you do talk to corporate leaders on a fairly regular basis, it seems like. Do they actually welcome the scrutiny and the chance to do better than they have in the past? Or is this a bit more grudging than that?
I think you get both things. Once they understand the economic and the human costs, some of them really rise to the occasion. And one person who's done that is Michael Roth, who is head of IPG, you know, the McCann agency. It's a collection of advertising agencies. And, of course, we've all watched Mad Men. We understand that, you know, advertising has been a hotbed of a lot of this bad behavior. But I think Michael really got very quickly the corrosiveness of this. He's a big believer in the importance of diversity if you are the voice of the culture. You know, clearly advertisers are trying to capture that. So he saw that the predatory behavior, you know, the running off, the forcing out of so many talented women and gay folks and, you know, people of color was just incredibly bad news for his sector. And he got very real very suddenly. I want to say last spring, something like that. But, you know, his firm has done really cutting-edge things over the last year, including the zero tolerance, which then resulted in investigations and heads actually rolling. I mean, it happened. But secondly, a huge push in terms of how to make inclusion happen. And I think that goes from daily interactions on a team, how you introduce people on conference calls, how you make, you know, the folks who are not mini-me's feel heard and valued in the creative discussion. You know, there's a lot of markers now in that culture and guidelines which are making a lot of difference.
Okay, we're getting somewhere anyway. The book is called Me Too in the Corporate World, Power, Privilege, and the Path Forward. It's the work of Sylvia Ann Hewlett, who founded the Center for Talent Innovation. Sylvia, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Take care. That'll do it for today's exchange. Our producers are John Baxter and Angela Decker, student Randy Babbitt at the controls today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Have a great day.